So I'm, as you can see, a professor in engineering and technology management, which means that I've been kind of faking to be an engineer for the last 13 years, even though all of my degrees are in management, so I'm a social scientist by training. Nevertheless, I would like to talk a little bit about technology before we talk about participatory modeling, and this should look familiar to you. That's the slide we had yesterday that I recreated, and I think we talked about two big drivers of sustainable urban systems, of climate change and population growth, but there's another one that I think is super important to look at and that we haven't looked at much yet, that's technology. And of course, technology is embedded in engineered systems. What I mean by technology is those technologies that we call smart cities technologies that are really, really changing the fabric of the urban, of urban systems. And smart cities working definition is use information and communication technology for data collection, data analysis, and data-based decision-making, so the topic of this conference, in order to identify and anticipate citizens' problems and provide services. And the hope in all of this is that this manages growth in order to improve quality of life, efficiency, environmental sustainability, and resilience. So very high hopes for those technologies. And this is not entirely science fiction. If you used Uber this morning, and then you already used a smart cities technology, and you used predictive modeling to know how long it would take you to get on the car and how long it would take you to be dropped off here. And so these technologies are rapidly evolving right now, driven by very large tech companies and a gazillion of small startups that are working on this. And the how is quite simple for the non-engineers. Fundamentally means that things, cell phones, cars, garbage cans, all kinds of things in the city collect data, that this data is then uploaded to a network of computers, which we call the cloud, and the cloud itself says nothing about ownership, so parts of the data in the cloud could be owned by cities, some are owned by companies, some might be your own personal data, and this raw data is stored in the cloud, and the advantage of the cloud is that it scales incredibly quickly, and we can therefore store large amounts of data very effectively and at very low cost. And then this data is selected and organized in order to be able to make decisions, and the data is then processed to answer questions for decision making. And most of the data today is still processed for humans to make decisions, and some of this data actually is already used so that software can make decisions. So if you have an automatic traffic signaling system that adjusts to traffic flows, an algorithm says turn this light on or off. Most decisions, of course, are still we want to manage our water in the city, what kind of data do we need to aggregate, and then human decision makers are taking action. And when they take action, that changes the city, leads to new data, and the hope is that this leads to this continuous cycle of improvement and increased efficiency and all the good things we hope smart cities achieve. What kind of data analysis, what kind of decision support do we need to provide? There is the question of what is happening, so descriptive, and these would be questions like how many streetlights are on or where do urban heat islands exist. That is just show and tell. Then there is why is this happening, diagnostic, and this could be questions like are elderly people hospitalized because of heat? And that's more or less statistic as we know it. So we have a hypothesis, we take different data sets, we correlate, we see what's happening. There is predictive analysis based on this data, and these could be questions like which rail lines will be disrupted in extreme heat, or how many people will take the bus next week. And these tend to be much more complex models where you factor in many different aspects of the city. And then there is prescriptive data analysis, asking questions about what do I need to do, what decision do I need to take. And this could be things like turning on an irrigation system or dispatching a garbage truck on an ideal route. Could also be things like dispatching police because of aggressive conversations in the park. And these decisions are made by algorithms. So that's kind of the world of autonomous everything. And they are often designed to be made incredibly quickly because they need to be. You don't want an autonomous vehicle to deliberate for a very long time if this is a pedestrian or not. You want this automated system to take actions, no humans involved. You also want, if you have an earthquake warning system, you want that warning system to turn off gas lines the moment something happens with no decision maker in between. So this is the world of smart cities technology. These are the kind of decisions we hope to support. And as we move from the top to the bottom, the decisions are based on much more complex data, so many different data sources that are integrated. It requires advanced skills to do this, so all the artificial intelligence we all talk about. AI has hidden layers, so very often it's not human interpretable anymore why, based on the data, the artificial intelligence recommends a certain course of action. And some of those actions are taken in seconds or minutes. So this has, of course, a lot of potential for good. And there are high hopes that this actually improves sustainability because it allows us to use scarce resources much, much more effectively. Again, if you go back to Uber, the idea with Uber inherently is that, well, maybe we need fewer cars because we now have the ability to share resources. And so we can cram in more people in a smaller space and still ensure quality of life. So efficient use of infrastructure, predictive maintenance, maintaining the water main before it breaks, environmental sustainability, the idea that you can provide city services that are one-stop shop and that are tailored for particular groups, that you might actually even offer help to certain groups before the need is very clear. Improved quality of life, wayfinding for people with disabilities, for example, effective and equitable public safety. So there are long, long lists of those brave new worlds that will happen based on those technologies. Of course, there are lots of concerns. Privacy, we've all have talked about this and thought about this. Security, so if everything is connected, any kind of problem in the system very quickly trickles to the entire system. And so this picture shows a blackout because of a data glitch that affects hundreds and thousands of people. There are a lot of things, and this is where I'm closing the loop to participatory modeling, where I think we need community input. There are lots of questions around ethics and equity in these systems, about who is displaced, who gets the technology first, if we are aggravating biases that simply because we're using data that was biased inherently and now we have an algorithm that just carries that forward. And that little picture here is from the MIT Technology Review, and this is the famous social psychology experiment, the trolley experiment, where people are tested on ethics. Do they sacrifice the fat guy or the workers on the rail line? So this is the same experiment, this time done for an autonomous vehicle that has the option to kill the grandma, the baby, or the passengers in the car. And what this group of researchers did is they administered that survey in different regions of the world, and they found that in Western societies where we value youth, we always save the baby. Whereas in other societies where older people are highly respected, we tend to save the grandmother. And the conclusion of the paper says, well, maybe that means we need to program autonomous vehicles differently depending on what region of the world they're deployed to. And clearly, this doesn't sound like a very good solution to this ethical dilemma. So there's a lot of work there.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of work in that space where we need community inputs to understand preferences and value systems. And these are non-technical questions, but that are very important for technology. Another question in this context is nudges. So we have this idea that with smart city technologies, we can nudge people towards desired behavior, conserve water. And that's probably a good thing. Here are some non-tech examples. So this Tokyo train station tries to convince you to not use the escalator by showing you how many calories you burn by taking the staircase. But now for the first time, we're doing this in a personalized, technology facilitated way for millions and millions of people at a time. And so the question, what nudges are okay, ethical, who gets to decide? And that technology changes our behavior is no news to us. So this is the announcement of the new Pope in 2005 and in 2013. Clearly detect a difference there. And those nudges today are already super personalized. So if you're using Netflix and you watch the movies on the left-hand side, an algorithm produces the top picture to suggest what else you could view. And if you're using Netflix and you watch the ones on the right-hand side, the algorithm automatically creates the bottom picture and shows you the bottom picture. So we are not seeing the same Netflix. The profile is adjusted to whatever your past behavior was. And then, of course, we have real conversations around, well, what's a rate of change that's still okay for humans? How fast is change too fast for us? And when is it too slow? If I know my kids are exposed to air pollution, is a government process that takes 10 years to clean something up an acceptable response time? So there are issues there as well. So to set the stage as a consequence of all of this, there is uncertainty about the future. And we do not know what those smart cities that are so massively affected by technology will look like in the future. And a lot of this depends on decisions that are being made and their path dependencies. So the future is quite uncertain. And participatory modeling can help manage this uncertainty. And there are four types of uncertainty that we can identify, and the matching response in participatory modeling. So state uncertainty means a variable is known, but the value is unknown. So I know that household size determines or has something to do with how much water people will use. I just don't know what the average household size will be. There I can simply run the model for multiple variables, and then I know an answer. Effect uncertainty would be where the variable is known, but the impacts are unknown. And there I can run the model with variables and see what kind of behavior emerges. And that's the main reason why we build complex models, because we want to see how, when all of those different factors interact, well, what happens.
Can you define participatory? I guess I missed it.
Oh, okay, sorry. So participatory modeling simply means building models of complex systems with the stakeholders and experts involved in the system. And so in effect uncertainty, typical use of modeling. Response uncertainty, the model doesn't give you an answer. It doesn't tell you what you need to do to conserve water. But it helps you identify leverage points. So where in the system are those knobs you can turn to improve things? And it can help, because everybody now has the same knowledge about how the system works, help groups of people to innovate solutions. And then there are what we in management often call unknown unknowns, or unk-unks. And unk-unks are those types of uncertainty where we don't even know that we don't know. So we should know this, it's important for something, we are not even aware that this thing is important to us. And participatory modeling doesn't have an easy solution to this, but the reason why we do participatory modeling is because by having more diversity in opinions, the hope is there are fewer blind spots and we can uncover more of those unknown unknowns. And so Moira has set the stage yesterday by talking about different participatory modeling projects she did. Beth talked about civil technologies, which is a lot of the smart city things that I've mentioned before. So in the last few slides, I just want to show how I think we could be using those evolving technologies for participatory modeling and what questions we should ask of those technologies using participatory modeling. And the technique I use a lot is called fuzzy cognitive maps, and Stephen Gray was invited me. We actually met through this method, so he clearly is an expert on this. And I don't want to give a methods tutorial in the next 5 minutes. Just on a very high level, fuzzy cognitive maps are used to analyze interrelationships, causal relationships between phenomena or between variables that are represented as causal maps. And a causal map could be something like this. And so on the right-hand side is the statement that a stakeholder might make about their theories about how wildfires emerge and the leading causes of wildfires. And we can translate this into a causal map on the left-hand side. And so what fuzzy cognitive maps do is they treat this causal structure as a neural network. So if you remember biology, a neuron is a primitive information processor that receives input and then transfers this into an output signal that goes to other neurons. And in a fuzzy cognitive map, we think of those little bubbles, those variables that are causally connected as neurons. And so these would be, if we go back to our first slide, this would be things like climate change and demographic change and technology on the left-hand side, and they go into another concept. And that concept, as a result of that, changes and transmits its change impulse to all the other concepts that are in this network. And there's by now a lot of literature and practice and software on fuzzy cognitive maps modeling. A big advantage of FCM is that you really start with these very simple bubble and error diagrams. And so stakeholders get that very quickly. A second advantage is that you can operate with dimensionless concepts. So things like political stability are rather hard to measure, but you can actually build computational models with concepts like political stability or customer satisfaction. And that allows you to do things like understanding policy preferences. So if you have this model, you can do all the different things I just mentioned when I talked about uncertainty. This is from a study where we compared the cognitive maps of different stakeholders about a wildfire policy. And without reading any details, same intervention, this is what the stakeholders think will happen in response to this intervention. And simply if you look at the pattern, I think it's quite clear that they won't agree on much because they all have very different theories on what will happen in response to this one particular intervention. So that's the kind of things you can do with FCM. And there are kind of two flavors of studies. There are studies where you say, well, this is our opportunity when we don't have a lot of data, but we have true expertise. Let's talk to this expert and take this expert's knowledge of how the system works, convert it into a model, and use the expertise to produce a model that we can continue to work with. And we've done studies that do just that. And there we usually go back to this expert multiple times to really get it right, to really get the system knowledge. Usually we have a relatively constrained, well-bounded question, and we are trying to really get it right, to really understand what the known facts about the system are. And sometimes we have studies where we are building similar models, but this time with stakeholders. And then we think of this model less as this is the truth, this is reality, but this is how these different people perceive the system to function, why they think the way they think. And the model is the boundary object and helps people to have a conversation about what they want in this system, where they want to intervene, what they think is good or bad. And the philosophy there is really more it's a socially constructed boundary object for conversation purposes. And then there are mixed approaches where you say, well, let's first take the data, the science, the literature, build a core model, and then let's localize and contextualize this core model using the input of the local stakeholders. So I think there are two tasks for participatory modeling in that smart cities context. So we need to model the impacts of those technologies. We cannot ignore what is happening in the technology field right now. And so participatory modeling can be used for answering a lot of questions like what features does a smart parking meter need to have, or what drives the decision to implement smart water meters, or will drip generation increase, decrease, or stay the same when autonomous vehicles are adopted? how will low-income families be affected? What are alternative future scenarios for Austin in 2100? Because as Laura pointed out yesterday, 50 years ago, everybody was thinking that the car industry in Detroit would lead to a continuously growing city. So probably looking at just one future, if you have the same level of disruption of technology, it might not be a smart thing. So using participatory modeling to understand those emerging technologies that will absolutely impact urban systems in the future is, I think, one call to arms. There also is a second call to arms, and I think this is, we should think about how can we use those technologies to improve participatory modeling, to improve participation, get broader stakeholder input, deeper understanding of those systems, better data. And so these are all the issues that Beth has raised yesterday, the issue of open data. Can we merge open data with participatory modeling techniques to understand systems better? There are sensor networks out there. There's a lot of opportunistic data collection already happening. You're all carrying 8 to 12 sensors in your pocket at every time, and you were willing to pay for this yourself, and you're taking them everywhere you go, and you should even take them to the bathroom. So this is insane amounts of data that we are all producing every single day. Are we really, as researchers who want to understand sustainable urban systems, are we leveraging this data? And can we merge these data sets with participatory approaches to get to the answers we're interested in? Intercept studies. How would it be if you stepped off a city bus and your phone gave you a little thing and said, okay, how was your ride experience just now? This would be so much better data than sending a bunch of grad students door to door and asking people, well, what's your experience with public transportation? It would be in the moment, it would actually capture the mood. We could do that as researchers if we leverage those existing technologies better. There's street furniture that's being equipped with smart city technology, talking trash cans or light lampposts that you can interact with. What an opportunity for data collection. So let's think about this. Co-creation of system models through technology, so we can collect data collect input from many different people through web interfaces and merge them. And then there's a rapidly evolving capabilities in natural language processing to make sense of unstructured textual data. And so what if we use these technologies in order to make sense of the public comments we get in all those lengthy sessions or on websites? So lots and lots of opportunities to leverage this emerging technology base for good. And as the last thing, I want to remind you that the core engineered system today is probably not so fundamentally different from 100 years ago. So this is a picture from 1916. This is a famous suffragette in London at the time. And see what she is using for transportation, an electric scooter. They have been around in 1916. They were used for quite some years, and this somehow went away. So why is there this craziness around electric scooters right now? Not because scooters have been innovated. Because connected technologies are weaving those scooters into the urban fabric in completely new modes of interaction. And this is where the action is. And so my call is really, let's make sure we stay ahead of the curve, or at least are with that wave of technology development as participatory modelers. And that's all I have. Thank you. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you. Lots of time for questions for Antonio.
You mentioned equity, and we had a long conversation yesterday about what equity was, and I think I realized I don't know what it is. So how do you think about equity? What is equity?
So I don't have a good, clean definition either, but I think it's really the notion that resources are equally accessible to all people, and resources as in transportation, as in employment, as in education, as in health care. And with smart city technologies, there is a real danger that a lot of people are employed in transportation, for example. If transportation becomes autonomous, we will probably lose about 13% of the labor force that is somehow in some way or form busy transporting goods right now. What do we do with those people? These are relatively well-paying jobs for relatively limited education. That's an equity issue. That's a massive equity issue. Yeah.
No, I just want to add to that. After it, Michael, we saw that cartoon, remember, at the NCSC meeting. I don't know how to explain it, but essentially there's this picture that shows kids of different ages, so they have different heights, and they're trying to look over a fence.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with that, to see a baseball game.
Yeah.
If you give them all the same resources, like a box to stand on, then one of the kids will be able to see over the fence, but not the others.
Yeah.
But if you distribute the boxes differently, they all get to see. So it's not about, just to clarify that, it's not about giving them the same resources, but that actually we are sensitive to their needs, and their specific needs, and make sure that they have access to resources for those needs.
Okay, yeah, that's a good clarification. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Your presentation is obviously very hopeful about the potential for technology sustainability. I have to say I'm a little more skeptical about that, but I do think that whatever research agenda might come out of this conference has to be very realistic about trying to understand the capacity of the technologies to contribute to something called sustainability.
Yeah.
Right? And I say that because I spend a lot of time talking to technology people here in Texas to try to shake loose some money, you know. And all they care about is making money. And a lot of this is just being driven by what they think they can make money
mm-hmm.
at.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really care whether it's going to produce.
Yeah.
Like, how many of us want our refrigerators to
talk to us?
I don't know anybody who wants their refrigerator to talk to you. We're getting it, so. You know what I mean?
I'm completely with you. So I'm actually at best cautiously optimistic, and I'm actually quite worried because I think there's a lot of development where even as researchers we often have this idea that this is a big company strategy and they're really serious about it and they think about this deeply. This is not how this works. This is the Wild West, and currently development is we're throw something against the wall, see what sticks. 6 months from now, we'll try something else. And so I think the assumption that we get some kind of coordinated, super logical technology platforms for the greater good out of industry at that stage of technology development is just naive. And so I'm with you on that. Yeah.
Just to build off Ken's point a little bit, one of the other things that may not be so rosy about this picture, right, is if we're talking about implementing these technologies at the municipal scale, the internal sort of organizational capacity to handle that level of innovation, scale it up, deal with all the issues that come along with new types of technology. Have you thought any about sort of what the workforce capacity might be for this type of innovation?
Huge problem. So I completely agree. So and my big fear right now is that industry is kind of stepping in and telling cities, okay, yeah, you need this, and of course you don't have the internal capacities, so you can just buy it off the shelf from us, and we have very little control over what is happening there. So we're talking to the city of Portland, and they're actually currently thinking about creating an apprentice program within their workforce for data science and to give them the ability to judge things in-house. They are also working with universities to, very simple example, but they bought data from a company in order to be able to run analyses, and they are quite concerned that that data, even though it's supposedly anonymized and there's no way of tracking individuals, that maybe it could still be possible. So they are now employing a university for adversarial analysis and say, well, try to identify individuals so that we are sure that we're not using something we shouldn't be using. And so, yeah, there's a real issue. Definitely. Yeah.
So I want to think a little bit about and ask about contextualizing the models, right?
Yeah.
And actually, so there are so many research questions right now around how do we bring the biophysical modelers into the participatory space, not let them swamp it out, needing too many details and too
too much data and focusing more on that scientific level of uncertainty analysis. And so I'm wondering if you've seen, so we're struggling in a project right now with, we've got subject matter expert modelers, the decision problem formulation comes in, and we have a concept map. Subject matter expert modelers compose deep level knowledge models, and then those get handed off to an analyst. And what we're finding is there are many small tasks after the models put out their results. We're actually reconfiguring and aggregating and re-delivering that information back to a group of decision makers or stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you've seen, where you've seen progress on that, and
I don't have a clean answer. So what we are currently trying in one project is that we basically put a firewall between what we call the core model and say this is the science-informed one, and that's the best science we currently have, and then we are allowing people to, in a participatory modeling exercise, contextualize it in the sense that they say, well, in my observation, in my world, in my context, this variable and this variable is connected in a particular way. And so we say, well, you can mess with a core model, but you're allowed to connect to the variables that are input variables to the core model. And we're trying to kind of manage it this way by kind of having a hierarchical design. I don't know if that's the way to go, but it's a huge problem. Yeah.
So Charles had his hand up.
Sorry.
Oh, yes. In your presentation, you brought up artificial intelligence and fuzzy logic. One concern I have about building models is that as scientists, we need to have our hands in all details. And I wasn't quite clear if in your presentation you were saying that these are the types of models that we would need to build and understand. Because I would say, I would be like, that's probably not the right approach, because those are tricks to get from input, from point A to point B. And as scientists, we need to have a better method of building knowledge that we can get our hands on.
I understand the question. No, so I don't want to change the scientific process. So I have the same concerns about using AI and then having some algorithm that tells you, well, this is so simply because an algorithm learned it from the data. I don't think that's clean science. But I think we need to accept the fact that these technologies are deployed at a rapid scale, and they are affecting how our cities function. And so we can't look for the perfect science and the clean data while everything else is happening and unsupported by any scientific process.
So I have a question that's sort of related to that, which is, and this also maybe relates to some of the presentations and discussions we were hearing yesterday, but this is good in the sense it sort of brings all of these things together. So in each of these scientific discussions or data-driven discoveries that we make, there's a whole bunch of uncertainties, and there's a whole bunch of things that we don't really know. So when we talk about causal models, we have been looking at, you're talking about this scooter, people have been talking about causal models, as you know, for a long time. And there are uncertainties, there are ensembles, possibilities, things that we know, things that we don't know. But sometimes in these kind of situations, we seem to be overly focused on giving that one answer.
Mm-hmm.
We have to give an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And even the process of looking at all of these things with your causal models would generate some additional uncertainties,
mm-hmm.
and we need to
mm-hmm.
manage those. And sometimes we tend to minimize that uncertainty, give an answer, but that may not consider all the possibilities that we have, right? In a climate context, I would almost say that we overdo this. In a global climate context, regional climate context, again, we minimize that.
Yeah.
So how would you bring all of these things together in the context of uncertainty, and then how do you communicate that to the stakeholder?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm in management, and actually business is very comfortable with this. I mean, the one time you know something for certain is when your accountant closes the books, and that has absolutely no bearing on any decision anymore. You never know how many things you will sell next month, or you never know if your investment in this technology today pays off in 5 years from now. So I think there are many people out there who are incredibly incredibly comfortable actually making decisions under uncertainty. And I think we can borrow a lot of their techniques, so strategic scenario planning that is used in business and was developed in business is certainly a way to go forward and to say, well, I don't know how the future will unfold, but if I get a range of possible futures that reflect pretty much the entire cone of uncertainty, and then I'm making plans that are robust enough to work in within that entire cone, that's how I can plan something 5 years, 10 years, 30 years out. And I think as scientists, if we want to support decision makers, I think we need to look more into, well, how do people make decisions under uncertainty today? And they do that every single day. And there is a lot of practice around that.
Right. The only thing is, again, the cautionary note on the political side of things, which we deal with. It's the context that we deal with and how uncertainty is then used as an excuse to not do certain things or not, because we don't know. The science isn't certain. I mean, how many times have...
I think that's... I mean, that's a big problem, but I think it's also partially because we as scientists go out and we somehow behave as if you can't make decisions unless you're certain.
Right.
And so the example I always give to people who have issues with climate change certainty is that I say, well, if a patient shows up in an emergency room with maybe something that could be Ebola, would you want your doctor to put this person in a separate room and follow all procedures for Ebola, or would you wait for the test?
Right.
Nobody waits for the test.
Right, exactly.
So when uncertain, you might as well do the plan that... Exactly, and I think a lot of the problem is our framing as we need to be certain, and science is about certainty, but decision-making is not about certainty. Science is, decision-making is not.
Yeah, also, sort of going on to that, couple of seconds is, in addition to business, you could also think of engineering. That's when the science is translated. For example, I don't know all the loads that will be on this building over the next, 20 years, which might be the design life of this building. But each time when we enter this building, we don't fear for our lives.
Exactly.
And
you have a 100% safety factor or something. Yeah.
So remarkably, we're close to being on time, and I think this is a very important topic. And
I think
in your afternoon panel, we're going to address this, right? So I'm really interested in keeping us going. Hey, Phil.
Phil. Phil has been.
The last word.
So I'm very interested in what you were saying, because in some sense what you're saying, like decision making under uncertainty is really about risk, and assessing risk. The reason I thought about this was quite interesting is yesterday in our group, and I think other groups probably were grappling with this idea, but there are trade-offs between different endpoints. So when we think about managing for sustainability, we're really managing trade-offs. One of the problems we face in our own work is that you have different currencies, different metrics, and so the economists hate it because it's apples to oranges. And I'm wondering to what extent people have tried explicitly to look at management strategies expressed as trade-offs of risk. The risk then is dimensionless, so it's the same currency, and so it's you would have to define clearly your desired states, right? So it's then you have a management strategy which is risk to this desired state versus risk to that, and then you're looking at trade-off horizons, sort of Pareto curves, but expressed as risk. Are you familiar with that? And then we sort of incorporate all this that you're talking about.
I'm not, but I'm really not an expert. I would be surprised if there's nothing in that space. I mean, in management, we tend to, of course, then quantify risk in terms of money. So and then you can say, okay, this is the expected value versus this expected value.
Salamanders always lose.
All right, let that be the last word on that. Thanks very much. I think we have a couple of new people who joined us. Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
I'm Rob Greer. I'm in the Bush School over at Texas A&M. Apologize for missing yesterday.
Oh, great. Great to have you.
I'm Fernanda Leachy. I'm an associate professor in civil architecture and environmental engineering. And also, I'm
Tell us a